Welcome to Up to Date. I'm Steve Kraske. College sports is often sold on the idea that it's amateur athletes competing against each other. But that's a myth, our guest today says. And if athletics are to maintain a vital role in higher education, it's time to end the myth and reform college athletics. Dr. Angela Lumpkin says something else worth hearing. Anybody who thinks that athletes aren't getting benefits beyond what's permissible by NCAA rules isn't paying attention. Today, a conversation about the need to reform college athletics, a need that runs headfirst into what's become a huge cash machine for colleges and universities. Dr. Angela Lumpkin is a professor in health, sports, and exercise sciences at KU. She published a major article on this topic in this month's Journal of Sports Administration and Supervision, and she joins us this morning from the studios of KANU in Lawrence. Dr. Lumpkin, thanks so much for joining us. Good to have you.
Thank you. My pleasure.
Well, let's begin with one of the more provocative comments from your article, and it's this one. Anybody who thinks athletes aren't getting benefits beyond what's permissible by NCAA rules isn't paying attention. And you mean what by that?
Well, especially in the revenue-producing sports of football and men's basketball, so many of the athletes are treated to benefits that are outside the NCAA's rules or permissible benefits, and that's been going on for decades, literally.
But benefits and, like what?
Well, maybe like a free movie, a free dinner, a flight to someplace, maybe even money, clothing, tattoos, lots of different possibilities are out there.
Is that happening even at KU?
Well, I have no evidence on a first-hand basis to implicate any particular athlete or any particular institution, but there are lots and lots of anecdotal comments made by individuals that bring credence to the fact that this is happening and has been happening. When I was an undergraduate, when I was a faculty member at different institutions as well as currently, you hear stories. And again, there are enough of those stories that would indicate there is where there's smoke, there's fire.
You know, you also say this, and here you're talking about football and basketball again, the two big money makers. You say this: I would argue that we're exploiting these young athletes. You say we're using them and providing a free developmental system for the professional leagues. So again, what do you mean there?
Well, there's two sides of that, really. First of all, I'll take the last piece. The NBA especially and the NFL, those two leagues, because of rules that they have in their collective bargaining agreement, allow young men to go to college for 1 year in basketball, up to 3 years in football before they're even eligible to be drafted. And so the training programs that are provided by colleges in those two sports are used extensively by the two professional leagues to weed out those athletes that maybe are not good enough, to further develop the skills of the young men. And so they're allowing the colleges to take advantage of their talents while at the same time greatly enhancing those talents, and the leagues simply don't have to incur that cost, nor do they have to incur the recruiting cost of trying to figure out who the best players that might have a chance of playing the professional leagues might be. So that's one side of it. The other side is that the allowable grant and aid that the NCAA permits these athletes to receive, which is tuition, fees, room and board, does not cover the full cost of education. For example, if one of those young men wished to take someone out for a movie, a pizza afterward, the movie, a dinner, date, or whatever, oftentimes they don't have significant help from home or other resources to call upon, and therefore they can't do that simply because they don't have jobs, they don't have time for that, and therefore the real cost of college is more than tuition fees, room, and board.
So some of these athletes you're saying simply can't afford even to be at school, even with free tuition and free room and board.
Well, so many of the athletes playing at the top level of intercollegiate men's basketball and football are coming from situations in which their families simply cannot provide, you know, $1,000 here or $1,000 there for the other cost of going to college. And maybe it's an overcoat for a winter day in Kansas, but they simply cannot afford that. And so these young men feel somewhat exploited because they realize the millions of dollars that are being brought in by their programs, and yet they're getting, again, depending upon the institution, a few thousand dollars to several thousand dollars to pay for that allowable grant and aid.
You know, you in regard to what you said about the NBA and the NFL, you know, using the college ranks as kind of a developmental league, what's the answer to that? I mean, should the professional sports leagues be chipping in here to some degree?
Well, the reason that the NFL and the NBA do not do this is because it works for them.
Yeah.
It saves them millions and millions of dollars. Yes, there is a developmental league in the NBA, and one of the reasons it's developed is simply because of the one-and-done year opportunity, because a young man can play 1 year in college. Take Anthony Davis, who was the number one draftee in the NBA draft this year, 1 year at Kentucky, and then he can go into the NBA. Well, that saved the NBA his development, his preparation for NBA, and they didn't have to fund him in their developmental league. The NFL has no similar developmental league. And especially in football, those young men benefit greatly by those 3 years or 4 years in college, whether talents are being developed at the expense of the institution rather than the expense of the NFL. So it absolutely works for them. And I might add that because that is collectively bargained between players that are currently in the league and the league owners, the league office, that is not in violation of federal antitrust law and therefore is permissible.
So what is the solution there?
Well, I would suggest that at least we can look at what's happening in baseball. Baseball has a rule that if you're playing at an institution like the University of Kansas or one of the major revenue-producing athletic programs, if you will, that you have to make a decision after high school. You have to decide either I'm going to be playing minor league baseball, and there the major league baseball teams do provide the minor league developmental leagues, and most of the players go there rather than going to the major leagues immediately. You have to make a decision. You can either go with signing a professional contract to play baseball, or once you decide to attend that first class of a university, then you cannot be put into Major League Baseball or one of its minor league teams for a minimum of 3 years. You have to complete your third year in college. I would argue that you ought to make that your fourth year at least to give you an opportunity to get a college education. So my argument would be you make a choice as a graduating person from high school, or play professional sports, whether it's basketball or football or whatever, and that's fine. Or you go to college and you make college real in the sense that you make some other adjustments so that you have a fair opportunity to earn a college degree. And we all know the benefit of a college degree as far as your learning, your earning opportunities in later years.
Because your argument, Professor, is that under the current system, a college education, it simply isn't real, to use your word, for college athletes these days.
Well, again, let me make a caveat there. We're talking, and my article talks specifically about or emphasizes football and men's basketball. Mm-hmm. There are a huge number of athletes playing other sports who are much more likely to graduate than our football and basketball players in 4 years, 5 years, and the 6 years that the NCAA uses for its calculations. They're more likely to spend less time with their sport, and they're more likely to focus on the opportunity to get a college education. And so in that sense, the current status serves them better than it does the two sports that bring in the most money. The most exploited of the athletes are the ones bringing in the most money because they're set up not to succeed with their college degree, but to fail too often.
So you'd pay athletes from football and basketball and maybe other sports too?
Well, I think pay is the wrong way to look at it. Again, if you go back to the paradigm that I just suggested, that they make a choice before they enter college, that they really do want to get a college degree, then what I would do is I would pay them, number one, the full cost of going to college. Maybe it's two or three or whatever that number is more money than they're currently getting in the grants and aid so they can be like a typical college student.
So actually give them some spending money is what you're saying.
Give them some spending money, exactly.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And then I would significantly reduce the commitment to their sports. The NCAA permits 20 hours. That's a laughable number. They do that strictly for PR purposes. If you ask the athletes themselves in those two sports and too often other sports as well, they're spending twice or more that number of hours on their sports. And so they're not able to focus on getting a degree by going to classes and doing their assignments, et cetera. So I would pay them, those revenue-producing sport athletes, more money than they're currently getting the grant and aid, and then I would back off of the expectations in their sports to allow them to take advantage of their college opportunity.
And by backing off expectations, you're talking specifically about what, not scheduling games, basketball games, for instance, on a Monday night or a Wednesday night, as so often is the case these days.
Right. Football is not the problem. Very seldom do football players at the University of Kansas miss classes because they play typically on Saturdays.
Right.
Occasionally, ESPN or other broadcasters will play games in the middle of the week, but that's the exception rather than the rule. Basketball is the big culprit here, and that's actually has set the model for other sports, so other sports are following along behind. But if you've got an athlete at the University of Kansas who finishes a game 2,000 miles away, finishes that game at 11 o'clock, is then supposed to shower, get something to eat, get on a plane, fly back, arrive on campus in Lawrence at 4 a.m. in the morning, and, oh, yes, be at an 8 o'clock class, alert and ready to learn, having his paper completed that's due that day. That's an unreasonable expectation, whether it's a male basketball player, a female basketball player, or a volleyball player, or a baseball player. Those are just simply unrealistic expectations, and we need to back off of that, again, to set these young people up to succeed in college, not to fail.
We're visiting with Dr. Angela Lumpkin. She's a KU professor who's written about the whole notion of amateurism in college athletes, college sports. Do you want to join our conversation? And maybe you have an opinion. Is it time to pay our college athletes, at least when it comes to the sports of football and basketball? We'd like to hear from you. 816-235-2888, our email address, UpToDate@KCUR.org, or go to KCUR's Facebook page or tweet us at KCUR Up to Date. Now, going back to the whole notion of paying them, you're talking about giving these athletes in football and basketball some spending money. Why not pay them more to compensate them for the amount of revenue they're generating for their universities? I mean, the coaches, as you point out, are becoming millionaires. Why can't the athletes themselves make a whole lot more?
Well, that's certainly one option, but I think there's a misconception out there that most people have that athletic programs on college campuses are huge money-making entities. For example, the penalty that was just levied by the NCAA to Penn State, which is a whole other topic to discuss,
yeah.
But they said that the gross revenues from Penn State football program was $60 million. Well, if you translate that and say that's on the high end, but there are tens of millions coming in for football or basketball, depending upon the institution, everybody says, well, those are huge money-making ventures. Depending on what year you're talking about, somewhere between 14 and 22 in most recent years of the institutions that are NCAA members have actually operated their athletic program in the black. I.e., they have not lost money.
And what you're saying are the individual sports of football and basketball may make money, but when it comes to spreading that money out over the whole breadth of a college athletic program, in most cases, schools are losing money.
In fact, that's exactly right. In fact, the last data from the NCAA says that at the Division I level where the University of Kansas competes, that the range of losses is somewhere in the neighborhood of $9 million. Now, part of that problem is the cost, I would argue, that of what we're paying some of the coaches, and again, football and men's basketball being the two culprits, I would argue. But there are some other coaches that it could be argued if that money was spent otherwise, it would be much better. Now, I'll give you an example. Steve Spurrier, who is currently the coach at the University of South Carolina, suggested within the last about 15 months, it was prior to the football season of last year, why didn't each of the football coaches in the SEC, why weren't they allowed to give their players $1,000 after every game? Now, if you think about that and you run the math, that's actually much less when you add it up for all the players, giving them $1,000 for every game. That's much less than many of the football coaches are getting for bonuses when their teams play in postseason, win conference championships, or even when some of their athletes proceed to graduate. So the bonuses oftentimes that are in tens of thousands of dollars to the basketball and football coaches could easily be shifted over to give the spending money, as you called it, for these athletes and make it a lot fairer situation. I might add that a lot of the abuses that we've seen in recent years by football and men's basketball coaches of taking these extra benefits would largely be eliminated if these athletes didn't say, millions are coming in, I just need a little bit of, again, spending money. And $1,000 a game's not unrealistic at all.
You know, you're really walking into the lion's den here, Professor. And I'm just wondering how your comments are being regarded on the KU campus and really across the country when it comes to college sports. You know, I mean, folks have been talking about these reforms forever, and yet they don't really ever seem to happen.
Well, unfortunately, the people who are the highest beneficiaries of the current system absolutely do not want to have changes made. For example, the people who are the greatest beneficiaries of the current system are your athletic directors, your football and basketball coaches, your NCAA top executives. They don't want to change something that's working very, very well for them. And again, I'm not pointing a finger at any particular person. I'm just simply saying that the Steve Spurrier's making that kind of suggestion is the exception rather than the rule. You didn't see the other SEC coaches joining ranks with him and saying, okay, let's do it, let's go lobby the NCAA. Because if the people who are making the decisions, the athletes are not making the decisions, but the people who are making the decisions like things the way they are, then it will not be changed. And I might mention that the Penn State situation shows what happens when people are very comfortable with the power of certain sports on certain campuses, and it's not just Penn State, it's other campuses as well, then they're a lot less likely to try to enact changes. And changes in the current structure of intercollegiate athletics can only happen, I would argue, when you get people at all levels, whether it's at the president or chancellor's office, the athletic director's office, the coach's office, in faculty offices, working jointly with students to simply say, this is hypocritical and we need to change this.
KU professor Dr. Angela Lumpkin is our guest today. Again, our phone number, 816-235-2888. Angela, you've stirred up our listeners. Lots of phone calls here. Let's go to them now. Mike from Lawrence. Mike, good morning.
Thank you for having the courage for saying this, and I'll just come out and say who have been the victims of this. Jamar Samuels at K-State. And Darnell Jackson and Josh Selby at KU, both losing game time because of money coming from people because there wasn't enough money on hand coming to campus from either Oklahoma City with all the tragedies that Darnell Jackson had or coming from the East Coast like Josh Selby did and not having enough money on hand to survive and not really having the people here understand. The other thing I might say, you talked about the D-League earlier, it's not as much for the one-and-done people. It's more for the Brady Morningstars. And like I just saw with Aaron Miles, who's tried to get to the NBA for 8 years, who's with the Milwaukee Bucks in their summer league and been in a bunch of different D-League teams, it's more for them. And you also have that Jennings kid who completely avoided the whole college situation, went to Europe for a year out of high school, and has done quite well in the NBA. But I appreciate your courage.
Mike, thank you. And he threw out a whole bunch of names there, Professor Lumpkin. One of them, Josh Selby from KU, now in the NBA, was a star guard for just a year, I think, a star recruit for Coach Bill Self. Did our caller have a point?
Well, I think the caller, Mike, had an excellent point because he illustrated several people's names that we would know here in the Big 12, but they're pervasive all over the country. These young men who are coming from situations in which it's very easy to be tempted when you don't have and you see that your talents can take you places and can earn you benefits. And all of us know in our own personal lives that our heads can be turned when we see other people having things that we don't have and we would like to have, and we want to use our talents to get that. It's really interesting that you can be an excellent musician, and you can use your talents in the summer to make money. You can't use your basketball or football talents at camps and make money off of that in the summer, because the NCAA 100% controls what an amateur is. And but there was a wonderful interview.
Yeah.
It is crazy. Mm-hmm. It was a wonderful interview with the former, now deceased, president of the NCAA a few years ago. And he was he's a brilliant man, or was, but he was talking in circles about what is an amateur. An amateur is whatever the NCAA says it is. Mm-hmm. Before 1957, they said anyone who made any kind of money, received any kind of remuneration for your athletic talents, was tainted as a professional and therefore was ineligible for intercollegiate athletics. After 1957, they said, no, we're going to define an amateur as somebody who receives tuition fee, room, board, and books. What makes that magical or golden?
Yeah.
And I would argue because the NCAA says it is, and that's the only reason. Most of us who have gone to college would understand that college is expensive. It's even more expensive. And a simple example, if you see everybody in your class sitting beside you in a classroom with a smartphone, which is almost as ubiquitous as a notebook or a pen on a college campus, mm-hmm. and you don't happen to have one, there's smartphone envy going on right there. Mm-hmm. And so you simply say, I need that to be simply a standard student at X university. And you can't buy a smartphone on tuition fee, room, and board, because most of that money is going to someplace else. It's not going to your pocket. Mm-hmm. And besides what is going to your pocket, you need to eat on.
Let's go back to some phone calls. Thomas from Kansas City, Kansas. Thomas, you're on Up to Date. Good morning.
Good morning. I just wanted to make the comment that I think Dr. Lumpkin is right on the pulse of what has to happen. I think this, what she's saying, is so important to the overall success of the athlete. The athlete needs to understand that education is most important. That person that goes in there after even 1 year and he plays ball and he goes, he comes out for an injury after that, he's worse off than he would have been had he stayed in college. I think that this is a community, needs to be a community effort behind what she is saying, because if we're not watching basketball games during the week because of that college needs to have that student prepared for the next day's activities in class, then after a while, the organizations are going to get the idea that they need to have those games on the weekend. I know that she's right on when it comes to giving a stipend for expenditures. I had a scholarship myself back in the 60s. It was not an athletic scholarship. And I got $400 a month as a stipend, mm-hmm. for being at that institution as long as my grades were up. And so I know that she's right on the pulse of what needs to make a change in the athletic world.
Thomas, thank you for the call. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Let's go to Andy from Blue Springs. Andy, you're on Up to Date. Good morning.
Yeah, I had a couple of things. First one, what percentage of the basketball and football athletes actually graduate after 5 years, since most of them are redshirted these days? And the other item is, don't the coaches typically get that excess money from the alumni associations opposed to the schools?
Yeah, hang on a second, Andy. Dr. Lumpkin, go ahead.
Well, let me answer the second question first.
Okay.
The source of income going to football and basketball coaches and sometimes other coaches oftentimes does come from multiple sources. But it has to go through the checks and balances of the institution. So even if it comes from donors by way of some type of foundation, the university is responsible for what it pays all of its employees. So the source of that money, or a payout when a coach leaves or whatever, that's the responsibility of the institution to monitor, and it becomes institutional funds when it goes through the institution. Okay. Now, remind me again what the first question is.
What percentage of football and basketball athletes actually graduate, Dr. Lumpkin?
Okay, it depends again on who you ask. The best source of that is Richard Lapchick, who does a real good job of monitoring intercollegiate athletics. The NCAA does another job, and the federal government does a job, and they all use different criteria. The NCAA uses a 6-year graduation rate, and typically that number, depending upon institution, could be as high as in the 90s if you're talking Notre Dame football or Duke basketball, and it could be as low as 10 or 20% if you're talking about some of the institutions that are trying to become big-time football and basketball institutions. So it varies very widely. But somewhere in the neighborhood of 50 to 60% would probably be the best number to use.
You know, in response to both of Annie's questions, one of your points in terms of your recommendations for what needs to happen here is greater transparency, that folks should be able to really look online or look wherever you want to look to find out where the money's coming from, to find out what graduation rates really are. That's a big problem in your view.
Yes, exactly. Miles Brand, who again was the former NCAA president, put into action a way to monitor graduation rates, graduation success rate, as well as the academic progress rate with the help of others in working with the NCAA. But the problem with those two processes is that they still hide a lot of the reality of keeping young men eligible and taking much longer to graduate or never graduating at all. So the idea of transparency is really imperative. Along that same line, I might add, and the viewers might certainly be interested in this, talking about Josh Selby and others, one of the real issues that comes when you have these young men who are playing intercollegiate football and basketball at your FBS, football bowl subdivision institutions, is that most of them are unrealistic in knowing what their chances are at playing at the next level.
Mm-hmm.
And I think most people don't realize that you can be an All-American college player and never make it in the NFL, in the NBA. It's very, very competitive. The chances of playing in those two leagues from high school is about 1%. It goes up slightly when you're talking about an institution like the University of Kansas, but not dramatically. And then most people don't realize that the average time that you're going to spend in those two leagues is somewhere around 3 years. You have your whole life ahead of you, and where are your skills if you did not take advantage or did not have the opportunity or were set up to fail relative to getting a college degree?
Yeah. Let's go to Joel from Overland Park. Joel, you're on the program. Good morning.
Yes, I really appreciate your taking my call. And Dr. Lumpkin, my salute to you and your interest in these subjects. My daughter attended UMKC. We qualified for state and federal money, and she also qualified for work study, which she worked in the library and got paid for that. So she did work for the university, and she qualified for so many hours. I think many of the student athletes that you're talking about would qualify for work-study money, and as far as I'm concerned, they are representing the university. When they do that work, they're producing income for the university when they do that work as an athlete.
Right.
I think they should be paid the same as the person in the student library if they qualify for work-study. That would give them the spending money that they need above and beyond the tuition, books, board, and room, and they could then use that money to their discretion. Secondly, a KU, I happen to be a coach, and I've coached at the Division III level. KU player of a few years ago came and spoke to a group of our kids at a camp, and he stated, one of the kids asked, how long do you spend each day in practice? And he said, well, we spend generally around 6 hours a day, and between doing whirlpool, film study, and practice, mm-hmm. and in season, and at least 4 hours or more out of season, which would far exceed, as you have already indicated, the the time that the NCAA says they can spend. If they're spending 24 or 40 hours a week doing that, and you get $7 or $8 an hour, that's $320 a week times 36. That would allow that student athlete
right.
to live respectably. The other thing I would say to you,
just quickly, Joel,
I will. As we see games on TV, do you see parents of supposedly kids in the stands that came to the game from somewhere that are probably not financially benefited, and I wonder how they get there.
Hmm. Any thoughts on that last point, Dr. Lumpkin?
Well, obviously I have no evidence of how they got there, but any parent, and go back to the Reggie Bush case, any parent who financially benefits from their child being a student athlete puts the athlete's eligibility at risk. Now, it may take the NCAA years to adjudicate the case, but they cannot receive any benefits. Now, tracking that down, the NCAA has a very minuscule enforcement group to be able to enforce its over 400 pages of rules and regulations at the Division I level. I think the issue there goes back to the fact of if those parents did not have the financial resources, they're probably not going to be able to give money to their child to, again, have those other accoutrements that go along with being a college student. And I might mention relative to the work study, and our caller addressed that, if they were paid for their 40-plus hours that they're spending in their sport, I'm all for that. What they can't do is then have time to have a job because intercollegiate athletics is their job. They're spending the equivalent of what a lot of people are working every day with their sport because of practice and strength and development, conditioning, training, film study, getting taped, and spending time with coaches, et cetera. So they're far exceeding what the NCAA permits. And the NCAA knows that. It's their own study that shows that, but yet they refuse to do anything about it.
You know, one of the recommendations that you make here, you have a real concern about allowing some students into certain colleges who ordinarily wouldn't qualify for that college. And you say these exceptions occur with some regularity. What would you like to see happen there?
Well, when you admit a student who is then sitting in a classroom with students who are better qualified to be there, that tends to set the athlete up to fail. Certainly, most athletes are admissible to most institutions on their own merit, and I applaud them for that. And most students who are athletes are serious students, so we don't want to lump everyone together. But for those who are special admits that then have to miss so many days, have so much demand on their time, they really are set up to fail. And that's not what college should be about. College should be to put things into place to set people up to succeed both in college and in later life. So my real world would eliminate special admissions for any category of student, and they should be put in the right institution associated with their academic preparation to set them up to succeed.
Again, we'll put all of Dr. Lumpkin's recommendations on our website at kcur.org. Let's go to Laura from Blue Springs for a final call for Dr. Angela Lumpkin from KU. Laura, good morning.
Hi, how are you?
Well, thanks.
I personally was a college athlete up until 2008, and the whole process of it all took me 6 years to graduate because I fell behind. I ended up having to drop classes because of it. I mean, I played volleyball, and we were gone two or three nights a week, and then on the weekends for tournaments and such. And, I mean, I had a major that required an internship, and I had to keep putting everything off. Like, I was redshirted my freshman year, so I had to keep putting everything off, and I had to wait till my sixth year to be able to do my internship.
Wow.
And because of, you know, no compensation whatsoever, which I wholeheartedly agree with that we should be compensated. But, I mean, I had friends that wanted to go do things I couldn't do because I didn't have the money and I didn't have time to work. But, I mean, I wholeheartedly agree with you, and I wanted to say thank you.
Well, Laura, I'm glad you called. Thank you.
Might add just one other thing, because the thrust of this particular conversation was about ending the myth of amateurism.
Yes.
And I want to tag into that with making one final comment, which is a lot of people have the perspective that if you pay athletes, it will ruin intercollegiate athletics as we know them, and that Dr. Lumpkin is all opposed to that. I'm a former coach. I believe very passionately that intercollegiate athletics is a valuable educational part of college life. But I think we have to use better judgment. We have to end the hypocrisy. And I think a good model, maybe this week is a time to mention that, with the Olympic Games beginning in London in a couple of days. When the Olympic Games began, they were totally about competition between amateurs. And for decades, they consistently enforced those policies, and we loved them for that purpose. The world changed. Commercialism became more evident. It became more central to who the Olympic Games have to be. And athletes were doing the same thing. They were taking under-the-table payments. They were getting commercial sponsors. And finally, the International Olympic Committee said, okay, let's just make the games open for everyone. And you know what? We followed the dream team in basketball when the professional athletes played. We're going to see a lot of professional athletes like in swimming or track and field that are making money off of their particular sports. And you know what? We're still going to watch the Olympic Games, and they're not impure, they're not tainted, but they're professional athletes. Well, if we pay individuals in college and we defined what the parameters are for those athletes, like our previous caller just said, pay them, I have no problem with that. You know what? We'll still follow those teams, and intercollegiate athletics will still be a vital part of college.
Well, Angela, you've given us a lot of food for thought, and I sure appreciate you taking some time to talk about your paper in the Journal of Sports Administration and Supervision. Thanks so much for taking the time with us.
My pleasure. Thank you.
That's Dr. Angela Lumpkin. She's a professor in health, sports, and exercise at KU. Time for a break. When we come back, we'll talk about fighting fires, wildfires, in Missouri and Kansas. I'm Steve Kraske of the Kansas City Star, and you're listening to Up to Date on KCUR.